Morning, Chairman. Stephen Mayne. I'm a small shareholder and a proxy holder for four other shareholders. Look, just an opening request. I've actually flown on the overnight flight from Perth to be here, partly because you don't webcast your AGMs. One of your security people have confiscated my recording device. This is going to be quite an important meeting, possibly the last ever Rio Tinto AGM. And I'd just like you to make an undertaking that there will be some sort of public record of today's discussion. I don't mind whether it's a form of a transcript or an audio recording on your website, which is common practice. The majority of Australian companies actually webcast their AGMs. So can I have that undertaking from you at the start of the meeting that a full, proper public disclosure of today's proceedings will be available for shareholders and the broader public?
I have no difficulty at all saying we'll meet any legitimate and reasonable request for the proceedings of this meeting.
All right, because I've previously asked for transcripts of past AGMs and I've been refused. So that's been a little disappointing. And now that
we're not a secretive organisation, so let's do our best to meet the spirit of your question.
All right. Now, my first issue, you've mentioned in your formal address about the level of investment in Australia and a few points like that. I'm not sure that there's another company in the world that is headquartered elsewhere but has such a huge investment in a country. I mean, Rio Tinto has more than $100 billion of assets in Australia. You have no operations or assets to speak of in the UK. And I just remain baffled as to why you're not actually headquartered in Australia.
Well, we are where we are because of our history and the way the company's evolved. But I think what really matters when you start to get into that sort of territory is what is the result of what we do. And I think in my remarks I did observe that over the last 10 years we've invested about $30 billion in Australia. We've created a lot of value, a lot of national wealth, a lot of employment, a lot of outstandingly good jobs. And I don't think the fact that we're a company of mixed parentage, if you like, with some of our operations in other parts of the world, this is in any way dilutive to our commitment to Australia. We're here very often as leaders of the company. We have close and productive relationships with state and federal governments and communities throughout Australia. The entire board spent the early part of this week in the northern part of Queensland looking at operations in Gladstone, in Weipa, in Gove. We carry the spirit of Australia with us in this company. So there are, as it were, accidents of history and geography which have probably defined the company as it's presently configured. But I think we're as Australian as anybody in the corporate scene in this country.
Chairman, I think that Australian shareholders own...
Well, I'm just anxious that we... Well, I'm very happy to take further questions from you, that this meeting shouldn't just be, as it were, a public conversation between you and I. I'd like to see if there's anybody else who'd like to ask any questions, but I will come back to you.
Chairman, I've got a question about... a broader question about China. I notice we've got the big Chinese neon lights on the cover of the annual report this year. Can you tell us... have we had any discussions with Chinalco since they bought that 9% stake through the PLC shares? I'd also like an update on what the situation is with the spot price embargo, where the reports are that the Chinese are refusing to take our shipments that are on the spot price and accusing us of ripping them off and breaking contracts and things like that. Can you give us an update on where that standoff is currently at? I was also curious to read in the Financial Review that I think Tom Albanese, our CEO, was at the Chinese Leadership Dialogue and had prepared a written text of a speech to be delivered to the Chinese leadership, which was really going to give it to them, where Tom was going to tell them in that sort of brash American way how they should run down their foreign reserves and manage the currency more effectively and these sorts of things. And then he actually decided, when in the room, not to deliver that speech and actually delivered a speech that was somewhat more delicate and diplomatic. Can we actually hear what happened there? Because I was a bit disturbed to read in the press that we seem to be going in boots and all with the Chinese when we clearly need to be showing a lot of finesse in the way we manage this vital relationship. And
well, I think probably
final point, Chairman. On this question about our relationship with China, I think it does come back to this where the domicile is. That Kevin Rudd, the new Prime Minister of Australia, does seem to have a special relationship with China, speaks Mandarin, the only world leader who does. Tom met with Kevin Rudd in London recently to discuss iron ore and various things like that. And don't you think that it would perhaps be in our interests to be an Australian-domiciled country when we have this special relationship through our Mandarin-speaking Prime Minister, to help us in our negotiations in China rather than the British company with the brash American CEO going in boots and all?
Right. I don't know whether to take my jacket off or not for this. But you make a number of points, and we're going to give you a clear answer to all of them, which I will do with some help. And Tom can certainly give you his own personal blog on the China Development Forum, which took place in Beijing, which he attended, and I think that's the meeting to which you refer. Well, I'm sorry you didn't like the annual report. I thought it was quite an exciting cover, and it somehow projected a vitality and the extent to which Asia is very much sort of part of our business. So I'm sorry you can't give us a better mark for artistic impression, but we'll keep trying on that. As far as Chinalco are concerned, we... as I think is clear, did not solicit their shareholding in Rio Tinto PLC. They did actually come to see us the day after the day after they took the investment, and that was a very cordial and friendly discussion, during which they explained very clearly what their objectives were, seeing Rio Tinto as a long-term strategic investment in a very high-quality, very well-managed company. There was no pressure whatsoever from their side for participation in our management, seats on our board, or anything of that nature, since which there have been no discussions with them. And we look forward to seeing how that develops. But factually, that's the position. I'm going to ask Sam if he will address the question of spot-priced cargoes of iron ore, in as much as you are able to respond to that, recognizing that this is a very important negotiation process. Not only for the company, but also because of its significance for Australia. A few words on that, Sam, in as much as you're able.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairman. Obviously, iron ore negotiations are a very complex and involved and a lengthy process. These negotiations are particularly important due to the fact that we believe that the settlement by Vale, the Brazilian company, previously known as CVRD, didn't in fact reflect the strength of the market and from our viewpoint certainly did not reflect the significant advantage that we give the Chinese customers in terms of the freight content associated with the delivery of our ore. Our ore is the cheapest or lowest cost ore delivered into China, and we believe that our current price is not reflecting that. Hence, our request for a price increase that reflects the higher band of the Vale increase and then recognition of the freight differential on top of that. In relation to our spot contracts and the comment that Mr. Main made in relation to our breaking contracts, we have not broken any contract. In fact, we have religiously maintained the terms of our agreements. Over time, both parties have taken advantage of the terms of contracts with various options to either increase or decrease the amount associated with the contracts. In this particular case, with some of our customers in China, we have exercised minus options. That plus additional volume that we've produced has allowed us to announce back in December that we plan to ship up to 15 million tonnes of spot during this year. And in fact, in terms of that announcement that I made, we are tracking, in fact, with our spot shipments. There has been a lot of speculation and comments in the media, both about the negotiations and, in fact, in relation to the spot shipments. Some of that is accurate. Some of it, or a lot of it, is fact inaccurate and doesn't, in fact, reflect the true situation in relation to the market. But please be assured, in terms of your comments about the need for sensitivity in relation to negotiation with our customers, that we do, in fact, take a very sensitive and thoughtful approach to the negotiations. What we are seeing is part of the normal argy-bargy of the arm wrestling that goes on in relation to negotiations. And I expect that in due course it will reach a settlement that, in fact, will be satisfactory to both parties.
Thank you, Sam. Perhaps I just touch the end part of your question on domicile, then I'll hand it over to Tom to talk about the meeting in Beijing. I don't think, actually, the fact that ours is an Anglo-Australian company in any way impairs our commercial relationship with a very broad base of Chinese customers. I think there's recognition that iron ore, which Sam's been talking about, is essentially coming primarily from Australia. We have Chinese investors already in one or two of our mining operations in a minority. We remain always in close dialogue and consultation with the Australian government about matters of important commercial interest. Tom and I were fortunate to have a very good conversation with your Prime Minister during his recent visit to London, and both of us meet regularly with ministers of the federal and state governments. And I think that there is a perfect understanding and alignment between all parties as to the course we are following at any point in time. I think myself it is actually remarkable that Australia now has a Prime Minister who is a fluent Mandarin speaker. That's not always been the case in the past. And he's setting a pretty high bar for anybody who follows him in that sense. But I don't think you should worry about nationality issues when it comes to securing Australia's economic interest from products in which Rio Tinto is involved. The Beijing meeting.
Thank you. Yes, maybe if I could just provide a little bit of a backdrop. Once a year, this is the ninth year running.
A short backdrop.
Short backdrop. The China Development Forum meets as a group of international companies of all types around the world. Rio Tinto was one of the founding companies of that, only a few that have been involved. 9 years ago, before China was so fashionable, we began to take a serious look and develop these types of relationships on engaging in economic dialogue, understanding growth patterns with policymakers within China. And again, the fact that we've been involved with that for 9 years shows that this is something that's been very much a part of our strategic thinking and our predecessors' strategic thinking. As usual with a forum like this, they're interactive. Questions come through during the course of a couple days, and we're always asked to provide some written script up front. During the course of the 3 days, I was really encouraged by some of the questions I was getting. I mean, one question, for example, would have been, you know, with all of this growth we expect to China, do you see enough copper in the world, period, to meet this? Now, as a miner, we'd like to hear that kind of question because that really shows what we can supply that there is a demand for. So I certainly saw the value in scripting that type of question and presenting a reply to that type of question in my comments, which is what I did. And again, I think it's important to recognize that the key message I wanted to get when I was in China with this China Development Forum was the fact that Chinese companies will be investing overseas one way or the other, with Rio Tinto or not, and that we can create competitive advantage for Rio Tinto shareholders by creating a joint venture type structure which can bring in, say, senior SOEs, state-owned enterprise within China, but under Rio Tinto conditions around sustainable development, environmental principles, worker safety. And this can create a win-win situation that I think is good for Rio Tinto and certainly good for Rio Tinto shareholders.
Thanks, Chairman. Through Sir Richard. Sir Richard. Chairman, your 693,000 quid a year stipend is about three times what the highest paid Aussie chairman would be getting. And I notice it's 10 times the base of the rest of the board, which is also way out of whack with the normal Australian system, where a chairman would normally get maybe three to five times the base of a regular garden variety NED, non-executive director. Why is that so? It just seems out of whack. I've no problem with, I think we should be paying our regular NEDs more, but your whack seems to be a touch over the odds. And when we have this discussion about the domicile, which I think will come up later as well with some of the other director elections, I'm just conscious of your personal financial position in leading the debate on that, i.e. you make three times as much as a British chairman as an Australian domiciled Rio Tinto would ordinarily pay, given the prevailing board pay rates in Australia. So why are we out of whack with the prevailing Australian system? And Tom's $12.6 million last year, fair whack of that came courtesy of the BHP bid and the repricing of our stock. Under his contract, how much would he get if the board agrees to a BHP takeover and he departs? So I know that he's also got a minor conflict on something like that, and therefore it is up to the NEDs to steer that sort of negotiation. But what is the maximum payout to our CEO if there is the change of control under his contract?
Well, this is for Richard.
Okay, Stephen, thank you very much. You've raised some interesting points. I think what I'd like to say, first of all, is that having spent most of my working life in the pharmaceutical industry, it was recognised as a high-valued industry and they got paid very well, that as I spend my last day in Rio Tinto, at least people around the world recognise now the mining industry for what it is. It's a highly valued industry. That's shown in the share price, and I think we're paying our people properly in a global market business. And that's also true for the chairman. The chairman is employed to spend at least three full days a week in this business. That is his contract. He's not just somebody who flits in and flits out. This is a big global business that requires an enormous amount of attention. And the chairman spends an enormous amount of time on this business. And if we compare what he gets, because he gets basically a base salary, he gets no short-term incentive plan, he gets no long-term incentive plan, he gets no other perks other than a basic salary. And last year, he received a 10% increase in that salary in pounds. Everything in the annual report is reported in dollars. And, of course, the dollar has decreased against the pound. But what he got was a basic 10%, highly competitive in the UK market, and I don't think that is out of control at all. If we compare that in the global business in the UK, where we are now, Rio Tinto is something like the third major company in terms of capitalisation in the UK market, then that is absolutely where it should be. In terms of Tom's contract, Tom has a contract like all other executive directors. He's on a one-year notice, and if anything happened and Tom had to leave the company, he would get 1 year's salary. There could be some mitigation in that, but I doubt it under those circumstances. And in terms of all his other plans, they are contractual plans. They have certain performance targets associated with them.
all those performance targets would have to be assessed at the point in time where change of control took place. So Tom would not walk away with a wheelbarrow full of money on the basis of somebody else took over the company. There are very, very strict controls in place for that. And in terms of conflict, I think it's quite a wrong assumption to think that because you own a big piece of the company, somebody's going to come along and take it away. You'll say, that's great, I'll make a lot of money. That is not how people behave. The guys who run this company have been here for many, many years. They've put years and years into this business. They've struggled when mining got nothing. And now they're getting something, and they've built a great company. And they ain't going to walk away from that just for a few million dollars, I can assure you.
Thank you, Richard. Just occurs to me while I was listening to you, you mentioned in my case 3 days a week. It seems that I've made a fatal error in not supplying my timesheets, but there we are.
Mr. Evans was the point man in the Alcan takeover negotiations as the CEO of Alcan. Under that negotiation, Alcan got three representatives on the Rio board, and there were some sensitive government approvals with the Canadian government that were required. Obviously, we all realise that hydropower is arguably one of the most sensitive issues that any government will face, particularly in a carbon-constrained world. So my question for Richard, as the negotiator of the contract and the person who had of the takeover and presumably also had the dealings with the Canadian government, is are there any sort of poison pill arrangements or agreements with the Canadian government that would prevent, for instance, a BHP takeover of those assets and a holus bolus removal of the Rio Tinto board and just complete replacement by the BHP board? So is that actually possible under the agreements that you've struck with the Canadian government to get their approval for the Alcan takeover?
Perhaps I could respond to that. First of all, just as a matter of fact, I mean, Dick was a participant from the Alcan side in those negotiations, but they were essentially led for Alcan by Yves Fortier, who was the then chairman of Alcan, and Paul Tellier, who was the then senior independent director of the company. Certainly, at the point of that acquisition, we entered into a series of commitments with the governments of Quebec and the governments and the federal government of Canada related to a number of matters, including hydropower, which you've referred to, but also others. I wouldn't necessarily say that there's anything embedded in those agreements which could be called a poison pill, but what they do reflect is a very deep commitment to maintaining the industrial and employment base of former Alcan operations in Quebec. And in the hypothetical case where there were to be a change of control from Rio Tinto to another party, whomever that may be, I have no doubt whatsoever that that party would find itself having to make the same commitments as we did to the governments of Canada and Quebec, respectively. We're straying a little bit away from Dick's appointment, but I hope that gives you the answer to the question.
Just a brief supplementary on the last one. Do any of the undertakings given to the Canadian government and the Quebec government go to board representation of the company which owns and operates the assets?
I think I'd have to double check on that, but I do not believe that's the case, Steve.
No.
No, thank you.
It does not.
Okay.
With the very greatest of respect to Paul, I'd like to preface these remarks by saying I actually hold a British passport. My father's British. My grandfather died last year at 107, was the last surviving officer from the British Army in World War I. And I actually barracked for the English in the cricket. But I think we actually have a problem here, which is the domination of our board by the old British school tie, with our three knights, our chairman of Cazenove, our lord, and our chairman. And I think that objectively, looking at it from a shareholder's point of view, it is very clearly in the interests of the shareholders that this company actually be based in Australia. And I make a couple of points about this. The first is that the world changed last November when the Howard government was voted out. We made a series of undertakings to the previous Labor government when CRARTZ was created in 1996, which we subsequently broke and which very much upset the Labor Party. I think if you look at resource nationalism around the world, you see it with...
Wait a minute, what has this got to do with the re-election of Paul Skinner?
Because this is
a domicile issue again, which has nothing to do with the re-election of Paul Skinner.
I'm explaining why I will be voting against the chairman, and I'm putting the case as to why. It'll take about one more minute, if I can beg
your tolerance. One more minute, okay.
Now, when you look at issues like access to resources, like the debate over Shovelina, like the major government policy decisions over open access to our rail mines, even sensitive issues like getting back into Bougainville. I mean, the previous government had terrible relations in the Asian Pacific. Lord Downer, you know, was just very, very standoffish. The Labor government has much better connections. And I just think, frankly, that the world has changed and that this board hasn't realised. Did you see last weekend's 2020 summit, where the overwhelming message from all those Labor lovies who were gathered was that they want a republic? I mean, that actually goes to the core of how they will deal with this company by the fact that it's a British-based company when it should be an Australian-based company. And my point is, we will get a better run from the Australian government, and it will create substantial value for this company, dealings in China, dealings across the region, if we were headquartered here, if we were owned more than 15% by Australian shareholders, and if we had more than two...
Okay.
15 Australian-based directors. So, Chairman, I think you're the blocking point here, and I'll be voting against your election today, and I want you to heed the message that I think you need to get ahead of the curve as to what will create shareholder value for us shareholders in the future.
Okay. Well, I'm very sorry to hear that you're going to vote against Paul's election, because I think he does an extremely good job for this company, and it would be... not as good a company without him, let me put it that way. So I'm sorry about that.